Hi there, I'm Nelson Lee, and you are listening to Stargirl After Show.
This is the Stargirl After Show with Sarah and Sean. Your post-show breakdown of DC Stargirl with Easter eggs, exclusive behind-the-scenes info, and cast and crew interviews.
This is our destiny.
I finally know who I really am.
I'm Stargirl.
This is the Stargirl After Show.
Hey, Stargirl fans, welcome back for episode 108, where we break down Shiv Part 2. This is Stargirl After Show, sponsored, as always, by Stargirl.tv and DCTV.news, your best resources for news, media, and spoilers about Stargirl and other DC Comics properties. I'm Sean.
And I'm Sarah.
And as I said, we're breaking down Shiv Part 2, which was written by Paula Sevenbergen, and directed by Geary McLeod. Great having another female voice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was real important for this episode because of how much it deals with Cindy and Courtney, and even Barbara, I thought, has a very important role in it as well.
Yeah, it was a great episode overall. So why don't we just jump right in? Sarah, would you do the honor of taking us through it, please?
Absolutely. So we start out and Pat is driving around. I was getting vibes back from the very first episode of the flashback to him racing to meet Starman, and he ends up crashing his car into a pole
at what appeared to me to be 88 miles an hour.
Oh, is that what it was?
I don't know. Maybe. My wife said, I think he's trying to travel through time.
That would make sense, as much as Geoff Johns loves Back to the Future. If that was in there,
we're going to call that a soft Easter egg.
All right. I didn't catch on right away that that's what he was doing, that he was crashing it in order to make it look like an accident to give an excuse for why Courtney was in the hospital. But I think that was huge. I mean, Courtney recognizes it later, like that he loves that car and that is such a sacrifice that he's doing.
Yeah, like you really see that land on her, and her whole scene in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is Breck's best acting thus far on the show.
I think so.
Which is saying something. Like, she was sort of sad and overwhelmed and feeling guilty,
mm-hmm.
but not overplaying it. Like, it was just all in her eyes.
And, yeah.
It gives me shivers.
Yeah, she nailed that scene. It was... Yeah, her emotions were all over the place, but like you could tell exactly what she was going through.
Yeah, it was an incredible performance. But before we got to the hospital, we see Jordan and Barbara on their business trip.
Yeah, well, enjoying what looked to be a romantic dinner. Just by the sights of it, it didn't seem like there was anything going on there.
Again, if I can bring up my wife, she said, why is she having a romantic dinner with him?
Okay, so it wasn't just me that thought that.
No, she thought that too. And I was like, they're on a business trip.
Yeah.
She's like, that is a nice restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
she's like getting possessive of Barbara on Pat's behalf, which I think is exactly what Geoff and the rest of the writers want us to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And Jordan takes off to leave because he has to go meet a friend. And that's when...
So he says.
Yeah. And that's when Pat calls Barbara to let her know that there was an accident. And then when we go into the hospital and Pat's there when Courtney wakes up, and he tells her that, you know, we need to tell your mom. We need to tell her the truth about everything. And Courtney is very much opposed to it because she thinks that her mom will make her stop doing it, which would be the right thing to do.
This was more of that awesome performance by Breck. It's more than mm-hmm. just that guilt. Like, she loves being Stargirl so much, and she's just so terrified of it being taken away.
Yeah.
And you can see that in her eyes. She's pleading.
Yeah.
With her words as well, but even more with her eyes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Breck's performance in this moment is kind of the only thing that really sells that Pat would acquiesce to this.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
That he would decide to keep the secret from Barbara a little longer, because this is becoming a pattern with him. Mm-hmm. He wanted to tell her last episode.
But yeah, he wants to include her. And I mean, I don't blame him, but I also get, you know, Courtney thinks that this is her destiny and that her dad was Starman, and this is a way for her to be close to, you know, her father, who she didn't have much time with. So I get where she's coming from too, but.
Well, and she has a flying stick.
Yeah.
Like, who doesn't want that?
Oh, absolutely.
I wouldn't want to give that up. But yeah, she doesn't want to have to choose between her mom and Stargirl either way.
Yeah.
And if she was just making that argument verbally, I really wouldn't buy Pat's going along with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like later in the episode, he wanted to tell Barbara everything once they got home.
Yeah, but I feel like, and you know, Barbara pushed it off.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like if it wasn't for the pleading in Courtney's eyes,
yeah,
that he would have made more of an effort. At least.
Yeah, I think you're
to
right.
Tell her. Because if she said, you know, can we talk about this tomorrow? I'm exhausted. All he really had to say is it wasn't an accident. And then she's going to be like, hawa?
Mm-hmm.
And then she's going to be interested.
Yeah, that's true.
And can we talk about Shiv and Dragon King?
Oh, yes. So Cindy just thinks that she did exactly what she needed to do in order to get a seat at the ISA table. She's like, you know, I found her. I did what you guys couldn't do. And Dragon King's like, well, is she dead? She was like, yeah, probably. Like,
I love that he's like, it's a yes or no question.
Uh-huh.
And when he yelled, like, I really got the scariness from him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then he threatens, don't make me take off my mask. I wanted to know what's going to happen.
Yeah, like, so he's like coming across as real scary. I'm buying the scary.
Mm-hmm.
Because Nelson Lee, who I should mention we're talking to later in this episode, kills it. He kills it.
Yeah, he does.
But I want to call out one moment from Meg also. When he says that line, like, don't make me take off my mask.
Mm-hmm.
Her entire demeanor changes.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel her fear. It is palpable.
Oh, yeah. That's what made me so excited. I hope we get the reveal in this season.
Yeah, that was just real fantastic. I could probably just do an hour every week talking about how awesome all these actors are.
Oh, yeah, they all seem wonderful. And they all are so good at their characters.
They really are. They're fantastic actors and they're fantastically cast. And I just can't say enough good about them.
So in the scene, Dragon King referred to her suit as a graduation outfit or something that she put on before graduation. Did you catch that?
Yeah, I took it to mean once her training was ready or once he felt that she was ready to like take a seat at the table with the ISA.
Okay, that makes sense. And then we have another reference in this about Cindy's mom. I think Dragon King says, you know, you are so good at hurting people. And she says, stop bringing mom up.
I didn't.
Yeah.
So I think that's telling us that Cindy is carrying the weight of having killed her mother.
Mm-hmm.
Because all he has to do is say you're so good at hurting things.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even say people. He said things.
Yeah.
Which might just be a real deliberate way of pointing out how he sees people.
Oh, yeah.
As things.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. Also, she seemed bothered by that. Like, she's actually upset about what happened to her mom. So that kind of gives me hope for her in the future. Maybe she won't be quite so terrible, but we'll see.
As Courtney and Pat are leaving the hospital, we see Henry visiting his dad.
Mm-hmm.
Courtney like says hi to him and he comes over and looks like he's going to talk to her and then just closes the door in her face.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
I was trying to think, like, their only interaction that we really saw was her first day. He tried to steal her phone when she was standing up for Yolanda at the lunch table. Otherwise, I don't think we really see them together that much. And I'm sure that they do interact just with regular high school kind of stuff.
Like throughout the day, they maybe have some classes together or whatever.
Yeah. And so I thought like it was a nice gesture for her to do that. And she seemed excited, like, oh, he's going to come and actually talk to me. Yeah, it seems like he does not want to be bothered by anyone right now.
And she's probably a little guilty feeling over putting his dad in the coma.
Yeah.
Really?
Probably.
So she probably wants to express her sympathies. And he's just not having it.
Mm-hmm. And we had a wonderful Beth moment when they're at the pit stop and it's her and Rick and Yolanda. And Rick is, of course, you know, it's an eye for an eye. He wants to go after Cindy and not make a plan. He grabs his hourglass and he's like, let's go in there and beat her down.
He's being brash and impulsive because that worked out so well for him before.
Yeah, exactly. And Beth, she is able to stand up to him. It seems kind of like Yolanda is just going to go along with whatever, that if he decides to go.
She was siding with Beth.
She did come to side, but
not forcefully.
Mm-hmm.
But Beth didn't just stand up to him. She called him out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you hurt so much that you just want to hurt everyone else. You can kind of see how Beth, she observes, she sees everything. And that's why her having the goggles makes so much sense.
I did love her saying, like, I have a plan, a good one. And she holds up the goggles and it's like, oh, your goggles are your plan. Mm-hmm. What a shock.
Yeah, it worked out in the end.
I mean, it was a good plan. Like, let's go see who her parents are and what the goggle says about them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really, really glad to see some level of bonding between Mike and Courtney.
Yes, I agree. Because they just seem like, not even like roommates, just they happen to be living in the house together. They hardly ever interact except for calling each other a geek or a dork sometimes.
Yeah, but it's not, there's not even like a level of step sibling ribbing that you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost just completely different. And then at dinner, there's a quip or two.
Right, exactly.
And that's it. But look, Mike giving up pizza rolls to Courtney, that's a big deal.
Well, pizza palooza bites.
Yeah, I'm not going to call them that. Yeah, that is just a clearance issue. They couldn't say pizza rolls. So, Pizza Palooza Bites.
Yeah, and then I
don't like that name.
Oh, and he apologizes for what he says at the game, and I think he probably wouldn't have had he not thought that Courtney was in this accident, and like he was forced to kind of face his feelings and think, oh God, that's less like I said to her. But you know, good on him for taking the first step to say something to her.
Yeah, and when she vanished at the football game, and Pat asks where she was. He said, don't know, don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So you lied. Mike, you do care.
Yeah.
You do. Clearly.
Yeah.
That was far from the best heart to heart in the episode because we have Pat talking to the staff.
Yes. Oh, and he's talking about, you know, we've had our differences in the past and I know you don't always respect me. And he makes this plea that the staff will protect Courtney because... And he made a great point. Sylvester already was the Star Spangled Kid before he became Starman. So he was experienced before he got the staff, and the staff is just treating Courtney the same way.
Here's the brilliance of this scene to me is we don't think it's weird at all that he's talking to the staff.
Uh-huh.
Because we've seen what an autonomous character the staff is.
Yes.
It's not weird for us that he's talking to the stick. We already accepted 8 episodes in. Mm-hmm. Not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But when it doesn't respond to him in any way, he leaves calling himself out. Like, you're talking to a stick.
Yeah.
Like, you've lost it, buddy. Which is great. It's a great way to remind us, like, oh yeah, it is an inanimate object.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird that we need that reminder.
Yeah, they do such a great job. Yeah, and we see the staff does understand and responds, of course. Doesn't give Pat the satisfaction of knowing that he was acknowledging it, but lights up like and agrees, and we see later does try to protect her.
Well, it tries to keep her from rushing into danger, but she's able to convince it, like, mm-hmm. Dude, people are in danger and we need to save them.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's our lot in life, I guess.
Yeah. And then he decides, the staff decides that it is worth going.
I always think of it in the masculine.
I do too, but in my head canon, it has like the spirit of a, I don't know if it's Ted Knight, maybe, of a prior Starman or whoever made it, that their mind is in there. But that's just my thought.
It doesn't really have this kind of characterization in the comics. So this is new for the show. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe we won't.
Yeah.
I thought this when we were shooting the episode, and I think the decision was made that we're just going to gloss over it and not address it. But there is a slight ick factor when you consider that Courtney was in her Stargirl outfit.
Yeah, I wasn't bringing that up either.
But let's just address the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
Pat clearly had to get her out of her superhero outfit and put her into regular clothes before taking her to the hospital.
Yeah.
Now, maybe he had Yolanda and Beth do that.
Yeah. That's kind of what I'm thinking, because they knew right away what happened.
Yeah, they're in the pit stop. They already know what's happening. There's not a scene of them being told.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have all been filled in.
Yeah.
So my headcanon is that Pat called Yolanda and or Beth, and they helped with Courtney.
Okay. I'm going to go with that as well.
Because, you know, no place in Blue Valley seems more than 5 minutes from any other place in Blue Valley.
Mm-hmm.
We neglected to talk about the tunnels last episode. But if we think about those tunnels, Cindy got to her dad's lair from her house and from the school in pretty much no time.
Yeah.
So these tunnels are clearly like everywhere.
Yeah.
But distances seem not too far. Mm-hmm. Because Jordan also, he goes from his office down into the tunnels at the American Dream.
Yeah, when he first goes to talk to Dragon King.
And in episode 7, you can see the American Dream in the background when the kids arrive at the pit stop.
Oh, I didn't catch that. Okay.
Yeah, the clock tower's back there. And that wasn't added in. It's literally just right down the road.
Yeah.
In real life.
Okay. Then, yeah, it definitely, Blue Valley is a very small town. So it is believable that he was able to call Yolanda and Beth, and right away they were able to come and help.
Blue Valley is small. The girls came and helped. Pat did not have to strip off Courtney's clothes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going with.
Okay.
And you know what? Maybe that scene at the pit stop, maybe we came in right after Rick was told by the girls, because he didn't need to be called in the night before.
Yeah, and that would explain his strong anger, like his gut impulse reaction, because had he known about it last night, he probably would have gone after her last night.
So he probably turned up for training. The girls were there. He's like, "Where's Pat?" And they're like, "Okay, so here's what happened."
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut in right after he's been told.
Yeah.
All right. We're figuring all this stuff out.
All right. We'll go with that. All right. And then back over to see Jordan. He is in Mr. Riley's hotel room. And we find out that Mr. Riley worked for the company that was responsible for killing Jordan's wife.
I don't have any visual Easter eggs for this episode, but there are plenty of name-droppy Easter eggs. So there are two right in this one bit of dialogue. He mentions that Mr. Riley, whose name is Ed Riley, by the way.
Okay.
I don't know if they ever say his first name on the show, but I know that his name is Ed Riley. They said that he is currently doing very well at Firebrand Chemicals. Well, Firebrand is the name of a superhero.
Oh.
He's a superhero that dates back to 1941, and he was a member of the Freedom Fighters and the All-Star Squadron. And the All-Star Squadron, I believe, we saw mentioned on the show in the Red Bees file when that came up in Beth Scoggles.
Oh, that's right.
He was also a member of the All-Star Squadron. So Firebrand's name was Rod Riley, and his father's name was Ed Riley.
Oh, okay.
So I'm thinking maybe this is just an homage, probably. Or it could be establishing that this is this guy's family's history. His grandfather maybe was Ed Reilly. Maybe he's named after his grandfather. And maybe this company was started by his father or by him, and named for the grandfather's superhero persona or the father's or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that. And the company that he previously worked at, the one that gave Christine cancer, apparently, according to Jordan, was Bannerman Chemicals. In the comics, Bannerman Chemicals was the company that Rex Tyler worked for when he invented the drug Miraclo, which is the drug that gave him his Hourman powers.
Okay.
Firebrand is not a company in the comics. Bannerman is. So we've got that Hourman connection and then this other weird thing. Maybe he's just borrowing the name for fun.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's hinting at some deeper meaning. When we were shooting it, I never considered that it was some deeper meaning. But now that we know that all these superheroes were established in the 40s.
Yeah.
It's casting my perception of a lot of things in a whole new light.
I definitely think it's possible that that was intentionally done to start planting the seeds for a future.
I'd also like to point out, this is the first time we see Jordan transform into Icicle.
I didn't catch... I obviously saw him transform, but I guess when we saw him earlier, he just already was all iced over.
Yeah, we see him iced, we see him uniced, we never see him transition until now.
Okay.
And it looked great.
Yeah, it did.
Hey, Zoic Digital and Kevin Struckman, you guys did a great job.
Yes, you did. That looked awesome.
I know they're listening. Everybody listens to this podcast.
Absolutely. All right. So from here, we kind of split off into a bunch of different storylines.
Yeah, we just sort of bounce around between these three main storylines.
All right. Let's talk about Beth, Yolanda, Rick, and Pat going over to Cindy's house.
Recon at the Berman house.
Yeah. Sounds super safe.
So the first thing is, guys, you should not be so easy to sneak up on.
Yeah.
In broad daylight.
Yep, like, just right out there in the open.
Right up to them while on a mission.
Yeah.
Guys.
Yeah, and I love Beth has this whole plan of going to be like, oh yeah, Cindy invited me over. I feel like not even her mom would believe that Cindy would invite her over.
Can we talk about her little cheerleader jump?
That was adorable.
I need practice.
Yeah.
So let's describe the plan real quick. The plan is Beth goes and says that Cindy has invited her over, which is the worst lie anyone has told on this show, and uses her goggles to eyeball and identify Cindy's parents because, as Pat said in the hospital, Shiv is probably the daughter of an ISA member.
Yeah.
So that's the plan. Pat ends up going in with her because he doesn't know that Cindy's stepmom is just a horny housewife.
Yeah, that was uncomfortable.
You know, so he actually thinks like, okay, there could be an ISA member in this house. She's not going in by herself. Especially wearing Dr. Midnight's goggles.
Yeah.
If there were an ISA member in that house, I'm guessing they may recognize those.
I would think so.
Especially being on high alert for the JSA.
Yeah. And you would think that they would have some kind of home security cameras going on too, but maybe not. I would be a little worried about that.
Yeah. I guess she knew Cindy wasn't home though.
Yeah. Maybe they had been spying out in the open for a while and saw Cindy leave earlier or something.
Yeah, that makes sense because Cindy was on her way over to Courtney's house. So she had probably just left for Courtney's at this point. And oh boy, I can't wait to talk about that.
Oh yeah.
So much to say. But in here, basically we have this plan, like Chuck doesn't know who Bobby is, but Beth goes snooping and she finds the keypad that goes down to the ISA tunnels.
Yeah.
And the key code is a nice little Easter egg, 1999.
Mm-hmm.
The one we had before was 1941 when the JSA was founded.
Uh-huh.
This is 1999 when Stars and Stripes came out and Courtney Whitmore became a character.
I love it. I actually did catch that one. And then I just verified in my my Stars and Stripes comics to make sure. I was like, I think that's what they came out.
It is way back in the 1900s.
So Beth goes down into those tunnels.
Again, showing how everything's pretty close together. Mm-hmm. Like, she doesn't go very far, I don't think, because we immediately see that there's really bad reception down there.
Uh-huh.
And the hardware of Chuck is not able to really communicate with wherever his AI is housed.
Mm-hmm.
He's clearly not an onboard system like Jarvis.
Yeah.
He has to communicate over a network, so there's some signal blocking going on down there.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because it's deep subterranean tunnels.
Yeah.
But when she hears Grundy growl.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, nope. And turns around. Beth makes me laugh so much. I love her.
Oh, yeah. I that was wonderful. And so believable. And I feel like that's definitely setting up for the future. If they end up back in the tunnels, I don't know what Beth will be able to do if she doesn't have the goggles to help her and guide her. So I guess we'll see if it leads them back down there.
So when she gets up, she goes into Cindy's room. And can we just talk about the fact that Cindy has a giant portrait of herself mm-hmm. outside her bedroom in the hallway?
Yeah.
It is like 3 feet by 3 feet. It is massive.
Yeah. And then in her room, when, you know, we're doing the Chuck vision, it's just pictures. Like there's a few of Jenny Williams and Henry King, but mostly it's just Cindy Berman, Cindy Berman, Cindy Berman.
I feel like Cindy's in the ones that have Jenny or Henry.
Oh, yeah. I think so, too.
And then we get the photo of Dr. Ito,
mm-hmm.
who is clearly a pre-Dragon King.
Yes. Born in 1901.
1901. That dude's even older than Dr. Midnight.
Yeah.
Killed in 1947, mind you, which was the year, I believe, that Dragon King first appeared in the comics. So I think Dr. Ito was killed in 1947, and that's when he became Dragon King,
mm-hmm.
as we know him, with the hood and the scary.
Yeah.
Which and means...
the blinking.
Oh, the blinking. But that means that he was full lizard man when he knocked up Cindy's mom. Just want to throw that out there.
Interesting. I did not think about that.
Oh, I did. I believe I talked about it with Nelson.
Oh, okay.
So I have a little bit of behind the scenes on that photo. Nelson was not available to take that photo. He was in Toronto. So the lab coat that he's wearing in that photo, we had to send to him in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And his little sister took that photo.
Oh, really?
And they emailed us the photo, and then I photoshopped it to make it look all old and beat up.
Okay. I was going to say, yeah, I didn't recognize him, but of course I didn't. I haven't seen him without a hood on, so there's no way I would know that that was him.
And we know that he is Dragon King because we know that Dragon King is Cindy's father,
mm-hmm.
beyond the shadow of a doubt.
Yes.
And the letter to Brainwave from Dr. Ito mm-hmm. referred to Cindy as his daughter.
Yes.
And then really they hightail it out of there because Cindy is coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And how quickly can Yolanda get into that cat suit?
Apparently very fast, but I guess it does shrink to her. So maybe she just pulled it on over her clothes and it shrinks down onto her.
That makes sense, yeah. Like, as quick as you can get into a mechanic's jumpsuit coveralls, I guess.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Just in, helmet goes on, swoop, and then she's up tapping on a window.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, so they take off, and then Pat quickly follows after having the uncomfortable encounter with Bobby while he's fixing her garbage disposal.
Oh, she's thirsty.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to hold off on my personal satisfaction right now. So before we go to Cindy and Courtney.
Okay.
Let's check in with Henry.
Okay.
Because this is also exciting. Henry is going through some major self-discovery.
Mm-hmm.
We got mind reading last episode, but now we're seeing that he has pretty much the whole gamut of his father's powers.
Yeah, and I'm very interested in how the powers actually work, because he's trying to find some pills for his migraines, headaches, whatever's going on. And when he's struggling to do it and his head's hurting, the pill starts floating up. And so is he thinking, I really need to take this? And his mind is just doing it on its own?
It's so unclear, because he doesn't seem like he's in any sort of control.
Exactly.
I mean, he doesn't even, how could he be? He doesn't know that he can do this.
Yeah.
And so the pill floats up, and when he takes a hold of it, it seems like the noise in his head drops away.
Mm-hmm.
And he's found the key, and it's not long before he is trying that key in every keyhole in the office without touching it.
Yeah.
That is some pretty quick, I won't say mastery, but it's some pretty quick grasping of his powers.
Yes, I agree.
And it's not even bouncing off. Like, his aim's pretty good.
Yeah.
It goes straight in each time.
Yeah. Yeah, and he ends up finding his dad's secret room where he finds Brainwave's costume. And then, were those VHS tapes all over?
VHS tapes aplenty.
Yeah. And then the letter from that we mentioned before, from Dr. Ito to Brainwave. Yeah, I was saying that Cindy was going to be watching his son.
With a picture of Cindy, which was very handy.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, if you see this girl come to your house courting your boy, that's the one that's supposed to be coming over.
Mm-hmm.
And a picture of his mom on the wall. Don't forget that.
Yes.
But yeah, we go through plenty of self-discovery with Henry.
Mm-hmm. And then he definitely comes in at the end in the big fight. But I think maybe let's talk about Courtney and Cindy in her room first.
Give me your thoughts. Cindy comes in. Were you surprised?
I don't think I was surprised, because I knew where Beth and Yolanda were. So I didn't know what other friend would be coming. And then I was very anxious. Like, I probably had the exact feelings that Courtney had. And they played it really well with how she was, like, apologizing and kind of dancing around everything. And Courtney's just like, does she know? Does she not know? Like, yeah, I thought that was really well done.
Did they fool you? Did you think, oh, maybe she doesn't know who Courtney is?
It did fool me, yeah.
Excellent. I mean, I already knew. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't be surprised or fooled. This is why I keep mentioning my wife's reactions, because she is watching everything completely fresh. She doesn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I have to use as my barometer for surprise. But when Barbara said, a friend is here to see you, she like hit me and she went, what if it's Cindy?
So was she, did they fool her? Did she think that Cindy knew?
I didn't ask, actually, and she didn't say that part out loud.
Okay.
Here's what stuck out to me. I don't think that Cindy lies.
No.
I think she doesn't have any reason to lie ever, because being brutally honest is like her brand, and nobody would dare step up to her.
Yeah.
So I think her apology for how she reacted on the sidelines of the football game was real. I think all of that was real. She talked about her feelings behind it. Henry was being super weird. My dad was being extra assholey or whatever. And then Jenny was being so ungrateful. And when you blew me off, I was like, how is this even happening? All of that felt really genuine to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, she's also still messing with her head.
Yeah.
But I think she legitimately was like feeling sorry for having snapped at her like that.
Yeah, I think you're right. And that probably part of it is well, I'm going to be killing this girl in the near future anyway, so I can say whatever I want to her and not have to worry about it.
And I think that she has maybe a little bit of respect because she's like some sort of enhanced super assassin.
Yeah.
Basically. And Courtney survived her. She didn't beat her, but just surviving her, even with help, impresses her.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So, you know, Courtney's really uncomfortable through this whole thing, as you said. How could you not be?
Yeah.
I imagine the whole time she was just thinking, where's my staff? Where's my staff? And then she reveals at the end like that she does know who she is. Like, you thought your stupid little mask could fool me?
Yeah. If anybody knows you, like, I have not seen that many girls at her school around her age that have that same hair. That's kind of a giveaway when you have it out like that. But I mean, it's no different from, you know, Clark Kent putting on glasses and no one can tell the difference with him. Like, that's just a superhero thing, like, in the comics. I'm not believing it.
So Cindy just, like, real casually is like, rest up. Like, I want you to be a decent challenge. And I will be back after I've killed your friends.
Yeah, no big deal.
So this is where we start drawing our three storylines together. Cindy's arrived home. Courtney's not hearing back from the others. She's very impatient, by the way, when she first starts texting.
Oh my God, yeah. Yes.
She texted Yolanda with two question marks, like, 2 seconds after her previous message.
Yeah, I had the same thought.
Oh my God, hold on just a minute, please. And so I think it was sort of the same thing now, but now she thinks they're in danger. So she literally probably thinks they're already getting killed.
Yeah.
So she suits up, grabs the staff, and flies over. And Henry's had to, like, leave his place just to get some air, I guess.
Well, and I was wondering if Henry was going, if he was actually heading over to Cindy's to talk to her about the letter and to kind of confront her to get more information.
Maybe. Maybe everyone's just converging at the Berman house.
Yeah. But either way, he was at the right place at the right time.
He was going there or to see his dad.
Yeah.
And it's such a small town. Why wouldn't the road take him straight past Cindy's if he was...
Exactly.
There's probably 6 roads in Blue Valley.
Mm-hmm. If that many.
So Cindy is about to notice that the photo of her dad's missing because she's going over to the mirror where it was. And I loved seeing Courtney come in through the window behind her through the mirror.
Yeah, that was an awesome shot.
I'm going to guess that that is a difficult shot to pull off.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't need it. You could have done without that shot, but I don't know. It's just like some extra little thing that even though it was probably a little difficult to do, they did it.
Yeah, and it paid off because, yeah, we just had that epic fight last episode, and here we have another one where it looks like they're going even harder, you know, and Courtney's blowing stuff up with the staff and... Like, I think she just ripped right through her vanity and everything. And I guess she has no qualms about hurting Cindy because she knows Cindy will just heal.
Yeah. It's a lot easier to fight someone when you know you don't have to hold back. And in fact, that if you do, you might die.
Yeah.
So she blasts Cindy through the window. The second story window, mind you. Out into the road where she's almost run over by Henry. Who is very confused at this point.
Yeah, rightfully so.
So there's a lot going on here, and I would love, Sarah, if you would walk me through your thoughts as you watched this scene play out in front of Cindy's house.
So I loved this whole scene because Cindy is finally just like, I don't care anymore. I'm going to do what I want to do. Not gonna be pretending not to have these powers or anything like that. Henry seems genuinely concerned for Cindy. So there is some kind of, he did have some feelings for her. And even if he was mad and like how I thought if she was he was mad and going over there to try and confront her about, you know, dating him only to watch her. He saw her, thought she was hurt, and still cared and tried to go do something. So then when she is on top of Courtney and he's hearing the thoughts of both of them, I thought that was a beautiful scene because you could see him struggling with who to believe, who does he want to help? Does he want to help? Does he want to get involved? Because I could be wrong, but I think in the comics, he's been both, if he follows this path, he's been both a good guy and a bad guy. And so I don't know what path they're going to take in this, if he's going to fully develop his powers and then be part of the ISA, or if he's going to help at the JSA.
Isn't that great too?
Yeah.
That he's a comics character that went both ways. So we have no blueprint for where he might go.
Yeah. And we know that he is critical to helping, because he would take over for his dad to power Dragon King's machine, whatever that is. So we know that the ISA needs him, but I got the impression that he was listening more to Courtney and siding with her during that scene.
Well, it's also worth noting what he was hearing from them. Cindy yes. was just talking about kill, kill, kill.
Mm-hmm.
And Courtney was thinking about other people.
Yes.
Needing to help other people. But in the end, Henry didn't make a decision.
No.
He just sort of freaked out and accidentally blasted them away.
Mm-hmm.
And the green energy around his head before that blast went out is something that we never saw from his father.
Oh, no, we didn't.
So it makes me wonder if he has some extra powers or is just more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe his dad was like, well, I got to hide this green stuff if I'm going to use my powers in secret.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So it could just be more raw power that isn't refined.
Mm-hmm.
So they get blasted away and Cindy doesn't miss a beat. She's like, knife, knife, gonna go kill somebody. Maybe a couple of somebodies.
Yeah.
But then some drones come out and grab her and drag her through a manhole cover.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the thing. When you're a writer, you can write, they drag her down a manhole cover, and that looks cool in your head, and you don't need to think more about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the art department needs to think a lot about it, because we are not dragging an actress into a sewer.
Yeah, fair point.
So what we did was, on our soundstage, we built a section of the road. We like recreated part of the street up on a 12-foot high platform with a manhole cover and a ladder into a section of tunnel. So when they drag her over to it and you get that above shot of her being dragged down into the tunnel, that's all on this 12-foot high platform on our stages.
Oh, okay.
That was constructed just for this one little shot.
Wow. That's so much work for that.
And then the manhole cover, when Courtney comes over to look for her and she like stands right on it after mm-hmm. it's been slid back into place, that wasn't on that street either. That like had to be built in and faked.
Oh, okay.
And they did a really good job. It looked like it was a real manhole cover there.
Oh, yeah. I had no idea.
It's just like a flat piece with some asphalt laid around it and blended into the existing asphalt.
Oh, yeah. They did a really good job with that.
Because the art department rocks and never gets enough credit on any movie.
No.
So then when Henry is confronting Courtney, he only says one word out loud.
Which word was that?
Courtney.
Okay.
When he says Courtney? He's not facing us the rest of the times.
Uh-huh.
But everything else he says, he's just thinking.
Yeah.
Out loud. And I think Courtney can hear it as well as we can.
Yeah. That was the impression I got.
It was so subtle because they weren't showing us his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And her realizing that he has his dad's powers and saying who his dad is. Mm-hmm. And you could see, he's like, brainwave, what did you think?
So now we know that he knows Courtney is Stargirl. So yet another person knows her identity.
Yes. And don't think that he hasn't thought like, oh, you blew up my car.
Oh, I forgot about that.
I mean, that's got to be on, like, that would be my first thought. It's like, I recognize that stick. Courtney, you blew up my car? God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably going to be a bitter moment between them in the future. Yeah, once again, Courtney was, like, her mind is just racing, like how Cindy was just, she was focused on one thing, kill, kill, kill. Like, Courtney is thinking about so much. There's, and she seems genuinely concerned for Henry, like, oh, he doesn't know who his dad is. Oh, get the impression of like, oh, he could be a good guy. Like, oh, that's kind of how I was taking it.
That's Courtney's superpower. She believes in everybody.
Yeah.
She probably still believes that she could in some way save Cindy.
Yeah.
Or make her good or whatever.
I think she does think that. Yeah. But I don't know if we're going to be seeing Cindy again anytime soon with the drones taking her away and after her father's threats.
Maybe she'll be a drone.
Yeah, that could happen.
But she is his greatest experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So he may not be ready to go back to the drawing board on that one.
Probably not yet.
We'll see.
She might just become cellmates with Grundy.
And speaking of Dragon King, we close on him. Unfortunately, he does not blink in this last shot. I was really hoping for another blink. I just love those blinks. But we close on him realizing that Henry does have his father's powers, which I'm sure he's going to go tell Jordan that they don't need to depend on Brainwave for their plan. They have a backup. Whatever the plan is.
Yeah.
And that's the episode. We talked about all the things to talk about, unless you had anything else to cover.
I don't think so. Just once again, very eager for next week to see what's going to happen. I feel like Henry's got to watch his back. Courtney now has multiple people that know about her identity. I feel like the JSA hasn't been together in a couple episodes now to work together. So I think that's coming too. Hopefully they learn some teamwork.
Or even to train. So who knows where things are going? It is worth noting, we do know the title of next week's episode is Brainwave. So we're going to find out more about Brainwave, and we will have Brainwave here to talk to. Next week, we have Christopher James Baker doing our interview.
Yeah, we haven't heard from him in quite a while.
No.
Seeing as he went to a coma right away, but
will he wake from that coma? Who can say?
Yeah, we'll have to see.
So we're going to talk to Nelson Lee, Dragon King, in just a few minutes here. And just super great guy. I say that about everybody on the show, but they really, really all are.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it didn't, we've got Shiv part one and Shiv part two. It didn't make sense to talk to Meg twice, though I gladly would.
Yeah.
But figure we'll give you her dad. So Dragon King coming up. First, I just want to tell you that you can find me and my friends on another podcast called Table Reads, where we read scripts that never got made into movies for good reason and riff on them. It's irreverent, and I like to think that it's funny, but I don't like to judge my own comic acumen. My co-hosts are funny as hell, though. So you can check that out at tablereadspodcast.com. Sarah, where can they find you?
And you can also find me on the podcast What's New Nancy Drew, where my co-host Ben and I break down the CW show Nancy Drew and try to solve the mysteries and make wild and crazy predictions about what mermaids and Hardy Boys we're going to see.
Did you say mermaids?
Yeah.
Interesting. Now I have to watch Nancy Drew.
Oh, yeah.
Mermaids. Also, you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at StargirlPod. You can find all you need to know about this podcast at StargirlAfterShow.com. And feel free to rate and review us on iTunes / Apple Podcasts if you get the inkling. Now we're going to take a quick break, and then we will be back with our interview with Nelson Lee.
Star
Stargirl After Show.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Stargirl After Show.
Well, everybody, I'm here with Nelson Lee, Dragon King himself. Nelson, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being with us.
Anytime, Sean. Thank you so much. Dragon King is here.
You know, you sound a little less creepy in person than you do as Dragon King.
Look, I'm telling you, in the beginning, I wanted to do Dragon King like Cobra Commander, but that didn't fly. I just thought, Dragon King! But yeah, they didn't like it.
He's already a little Cobra Commander-y.
I know, that's kind of why.
Like Cobra Commander just put his clothes in with something yellow.
Yeah, it was like, you know, his laundry day. He's like, I need to do laundry!
Even got the reptilian eyes.
Yep. Those were amazing and very painful.
So the entire time you were Dragon King, you had to have prosthetics just around your eyes, right?
Yeah, basically, because all the other kids and superheroes and villains had kind of panda eye. So they had that black thing. So, but mine, of course, you have to have the lizard. And I think it's amazing. And throughout the course of the show, we kind of evolved from like it taking an hour or so just to do the eyes to pretty quickly, like 10, 15 minutes. So kudos to the amazing makeup team for getting that down. I mean, it's amazing. Like even getting my, you know, the costume on took a while because, you know, everyone's costume is hard. I mean, I don't understand how any villain puts on their clothes by themselves. Like in all the movies now, I call bullshit. They just have to have all these minions around them putting it on.
Well, you know, you see those close up shots of like the glove going on, yeah, and the boot going on.
Exactly.
You don't see the six people behind them. Yeah. That's why it's so close up.
You don't see them like have a hand on someone's head like, okay, come on, get that on. But yeah, no, it took us a while to get those on, but by the end it was literally once we got the call we'd be rock and rolling in like less under five.
So I want to back out of Stargirl for a minute,
yeah,
and sort of talk about just Nelson.
Cool.
So had a look at your IMDb. You've been acting since about 2002.
Yeah,
about 18 years.
Sure,
but you got 45 acting credits in that time.
Yeah, no, it's been interesting. I mean, I guess I technically started was 2001 when I came out of school. My first gig was Law and Order, which was awesome. And it's funny, I just recently did another thing on it, so I'm like, I graduated from perp to cop. That's the evolution of Law and Order, and that takes about 20 years, I figured.
So I actually made a note that you were on three different Law and Order series.
I did all of them.
Playing five different characters.
Dude, I basically at one point was an entire gang. Like the Ghost Shadows was me. Because I played different characters, same gang. It was me. I was the Ghost Shadows. The cops, you know, just never figured it out.
And on top of that, you did NCIS and CSI.
Yep.
You all did the whole gamut of the police procedurals.
I know, it's crazy. Talk about, you know, great moments where everyone just looks up and then you cut the commercial. Those shows are classic for that. Good training for knowing when the commercial break is coming. Everyone just look at each other.
I feel like those are almost written with search and replace.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, no, it's been great. It's been interesting. I've been, as you can imagine, during this time, been doing, trying to fill, talking to a lot of people, doing interviews and stuff like that. I just actually spoke for my old school in New York and just like, cause a lot of the kids there are graduating or were supposed to, and just talking about, what to expect. And yeah, it's been a crazy journey.
But you know, 45 credits, that's the mark of a hardworking actor. You're all over the place.
Yeah, no, thank you. And you know, some years are lean and some years are real fat and rich. And you know, I talked to Neil Jackson about this all the time. Neil and I, that's why this show is great on many levels, Stargirl, get back to that. But Neil and I worked together on Blade back in 2006 with Jeff Johns on that as well. And so it's great to have Neil. You know, he's been my best friend for a long time. But yeah, just talking to him all the time about, you know, everyone thinks you look at credits like, oh my God, you're killing it. There's some years where you're just struggling and you're just trying to keep your head above water. It's funny how you just glance at stuff and it seems like it's just like all amazing. But yeah, there's some hard times, and that's when you got to lean on people close to you.
So I have to ask, just something that I'm generally curious about as an Asian descended actor.
Yeah.
Do you find that a lot of people in casting are expecting you to have some sort of martial arts know-how?
Absolutely. It's changed a little bit, but not really. I think more it's just because the only reason it's changed because now there is a lot more Asian roles. But oh my God, do you know how many times I've been asked to kick in an audition? I'm not even joking. It's like, can you just do a little something, just a little kick or a punch? It's fantastic. And you just see everyone come out of those audition rooms, just roll their eyes and be like, yeah, sure, I'll do a kick.
It's just, well, if it makes you feel any better, Yvette in her audition for Wildcat was asked to do a jump.
That's funny. A Wildcat jump. Yeah, no, but no, absolutely. And the thing is, I did do martial arts growing up and, you know, martial arts training. I still do fights training. And but yeah, you know, it's one of those things. And honestly, a lot of times when I've had things, you know, for instance, like on Blade, I remember they wanted to throw in kicks and stuff. I was like, I don't want to kick. I was like, let's make me a brawler. I just want to punch, because I was so sick of people being like, you know, I love Daniel Day Kim, but I remember him on Lost, he does a spinning back kick and he's a fisherman. I was like, what the hell? Why are you doing a spinning back kick? You know?
Yeah.
I was like, you set up this whole story of you as this humble fisherman and then you come around doing a spinning back kick on the island. I was like, okay, cool. Fine. We all do spinning back kicks.
So it's sort of like, do you do martial arts? Now, hold on a second. I mean, yes, but hold on still.
Exactly. Pretty much. And I was like, I won't do it. But yeah, no, totally. It is this thing that you just assume.
Yeah, it's, and just looking at your resume, there seems to be a lot of that. The gang members on your procedural shows and things like that.
Yeah, luckily most of those, all I did was shoot my gun sideways, like gangster style. So that,
oh yes, of course.
So that was my kick. That's my spinning kick.
So what got you into acting in the first place? I know you went to school for it, but like, what was your germ?
I mean, you know, like since I was a kid, I always liked and really enjoyed acting. I did plays and musicals and stuff like that. Never, ever, ever entertained the idea of it being my career because it was just too terrifying to think of that. And I remember when I went to university, I'm Canadian. So I went to University of Toronto. And I remember even there, I did like, I started in business because I was like, I'll do business because I don't know what else to do. And I hated it. My first year, I was like doing accounting and statistics. I was like, I wanted to blow my brains out. And I found philosophy, which I enjoyed a lot. And so I ended up doing my degree in that. Well, while I was there, I was still doing plays and stuff like that, but never again, still really committing to being an actor, even thinking about it. And then I went to live, fast forward to that, to live in Europe for a little bit. And it was over there that I started really thinking about what made me happy. Because I was kind of lost. I didn't know what to do. And I kept coming back to the same thing, like acting, be on stage, that feeling. And so then I decided to go to New York, applied for acting school, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, got in. And yeah, kind of just went from there. And it was very hard. It's every year, it took a long time to really call myself an actor, to call myself an artist. I used to call myself a bartender forever because that's what I was doing, you know, but still working. And my girlfriend at the time, I remember she always be like, why do you not say you're an actor? I was like, well, I'm not doing it. Not all the time. I'm bartending more than I'm acting. But she was like, but you're an actor. And it's important, I think, to do that, to believe that, because that is true, because we are. And you're artists, and it's hard to say that.
It's important to think of yourself as that, though I can see why someone just starting out would be hesitant to say it because there's always the follow-up question.
Absolutely. Like, oh, so where do you work? I mean, I still get that sometimes. Like, oh, that's cute. You're an actor.
What would I have seen you in?
Yeah, exactly. You're like, you look familiar. And then you end up doing the whole, like, your resume. And they're like, oh, no, I think you're someone else. I thought you were that guy from Lost. You're like, damn it.
You're Chow Yun-Fat, right? Yeah, not even close.
Exactly. Jackie Chan? Ethan Hawke? I remember once I was like, I went to, my little sister is like babysitting in Nantucket, and I went to go visit her. And, you know, Nantucket's a very privileged little place. And anyway, we're walking along the beach, and these kids, their probably last name is like Colgate or something, but walked by, and he was like, "Hey." And one of the kids was an African-American kid. And he was like, "Hey, Jackie Chan." And I went, "Hey, Morgan Freeman." And he was like, "What?" I was like, "Yeah, it sucks, doesn't it?"
That's great.
It was just funny. He was like, "Hey."
But I would like to know how Dragon King came to you.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I remember I was in New Zealand, still shooting Mulan, and I get a phone call, and, you know, and it's Jeff Johns. And it was crazy. And, you know, I haven't spoken to Jeff in a few years. And it was just great to hear his voice. And then he just started talking to me about this project. And I was like, "Oh my God. Yeah. I remember him telling me about this back when we were doing Blade." And I knew how beautiful and important this was to him. And yeah, I was just like so excited to even, you know, try to be a part of it. Put in a tape for everyone to take a look at. And you know, at the time I'd be honest, I never read, any of the All-Star Squadrons. I didn't know Dragon King, the character. So I'm just going off of just the script. And it was like, and you know, off of what Jeff is telling me, this really dark, interesting character. And the way it's developed and the way that, you know, he trusted and gave me some freedom to do stuff. It's so amazing to see the journey that we've come. And I think he just is so interesting of a character, especially compared to the rest. He's like this little, he's, you know, his own guy stuck in his little dungeon, working away. It's, I'm really proud of it, where it's come.
So you didn't, you sort of had to test for it, but not audition for it?
Yeah, I mean, we still, yeah, basically it's still putting in a tape because, you know, even though Jeff loves me, they got to get everyone else on board. So yeah, it's still put in a tape. And which is, of course, happy to. It's great to even get to be asked to do it. But yeah, no, it's interesting because you are kind of going in blind because you're like, okay, Dragon King, huh? You know, and the sides were, of course, dummy size, but it was a lot of fun. And, you know, got a lot of feedback from Jeff, just stuff to try to help us make sure that we get it. And yeah, no, and I'm so happy. It was so much fun.
It's got to feel good that the show's creator is reaching out to you directly rather than hearing about some cattle call.
Yeah, absolutely. And it means the world to me that, you know, Jeff trusts me with this material, with this character, with this show. I mean, I know how much it means to him, and it means that much to me just to have that faith. You know, he's awesome. Jeff's the best captain to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing that I found about Dragon King was that nobody had really done anything with him until Jeff got a hold of him for Stars and Stripes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like you mentioned, All-Star Squadron. I think he was in literally two comics.
Two. Yeah,
that's before it. He showed up.
Exactly. And it's just, and it's
two yeah. single issues ever.
Yeah. And it's so cool that, yeah, you know, and then you bring him in, have everything with Shiv. And that relationship is so awesome. And I love the way that it's developed in this show. The relationship between father and daughter. You know, it's so such an interesting thing because you see this character, you see him in his robe and his cape and the mask, and then you're like, "Oh, he's a father." It's such an interesting thing, especially and you know, countering off of everything that's happening in on the kids' side in the high school.
Especially when you consider the timeline they lay out for the experiments
yeah.
that turned him into a reptilian thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's like 100 really, years old.
It kind of makes you want to see a sitcom about him.
Oh yeah,
the Lizard Man and Shiv's mom.
Yeah, exactly. We always joked about him just like lizard face, like on a beach during their like honeymoon, just like drinking drinks out of a coconut shell, but just like lizard head but normal body.
Yeah,
yeah. Just you know, a little bit of zinc on the nose.
I do want to ask about, there's a unique challenge to Dragon King that pretty much no one else had on the show, and that was faceless acting.
Yeah, you know, you start to, it is a huge challenge. You don't really think about it until you get into it. You're like, oh, that's interesting. I have to convey everything And also I've got lizard eyes. It's all these things. So it's, you know, it's not even things you can almost narrow your eyes. It's just all completely physical. So you realize you're doing things with your head. You're doing things with the way you're moving, the slowness or the quickness. You know, it's, you start trying to find other ways to convey, how you would, you know, if you did not have, you know, any kind of facial, reactions. It's an interesting challenge, but it was really fulfilling to try to do that. Of course, sometimes you're like afraid, like, am I really boring right now doing this? But yeah, no, it's, luckily the stakes are all high. So, it gives us lots of places to go.
What really jumped out at me and almost put a visible question mark over my head was in one of the scripts, it's specifically called out that Dragon King is smiling under his hood.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's funny because I do that. Like I will, like I'll be smiling. I'll be like angry. I'll do stuff. And because you do kind of feel it, if nothing else for me physically, just to do that underneath all that, like I can feel it for me. So
yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
So absolutely. Yeah. You're still doing everything. And it's interesting. You hope that you can see it a little bit in the eyes. But yeah, it's crazy.
In that particular scene, I think that he smiles and then like his smile fades.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's written as being under his hood the whole time, and it's not even a tight fitting hood. So that must have been quite a challenge to convey all of that.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because sometimes you although sometimes it does save you. Like there's been many times, especially during our JSA meetings, where everyone cannot stop cracking up. Like we're just cannot stop laughing, and having the hood sometimes is good because there have been a couple of times I'm just like trying not to laugh, and you could probably see my hood vibrating because it just be like trying not to break up. Where everyone else is just like looking down or like covering their eyes.
Yeah, that's a good point. You get to hide that you're breaking.
Yeah, but yeah, no, the JSA meetings are always a lot of fun. The ISA, sorry.
Of course. You wouldn't be at the JSA meetings.
Although that would be hilarious
awkward.
If I'm there. I was like, what the hell is he doing here? Fooled you.
So we did find out... this is a departure from the comics. In the Stars and Stripe book, Dragon King's the big bad.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
He's a top bad guy. And there's really some hints in some of the earlier trailers for Stargirl that maybe that's the case here.
Yeah.
Because you don't see him with the rest.
No.
You know, you see the rest of the guys lined up, and then you get an individual shot of Dragon King.
Yeah.
So you think maybe that's the guy behind the scenes pulling strings, but that's not how it went this way around.
Yeah. No, but at the same time, you know, it is a lot of the Dragon King is behind a lot of the machinations of, you know, the Jordan's plan. But yeah, no, definitely it takes a little, I think it's a great twist to everything. And the thing is, I think you see, you know, you never know what could happen in the future, with everything. So yeah, no, it's interesting to take away from the big baddie. Cause also you have all these kind of baddies. You try to figure out who is really in charge, who is the one pulling, all the strings.
Did you and Meg work together at all in any extra capacity to try to find a way to hint at some deeper familial connection between your characters?
No, not really. I mean, the lovely thing is everyone is so great on this show. So it's just super easy to kind of hop right in and get down to it. And the writing's fantastic. And also, like, it's just one of these things when you do a show like Stargirl, you put on the costume and it just happens, you know? And yes, obviously there's this familial kind of father-daughter aspect that you're trying to find, but I think right away we just had a really great connection and we worked well together. And yeah, no, I think it just happened very easily.
Well, that's great. Regarding the physicality of Dragon King, how much of that was you, and how much was your stunt double being completely covered? I'm sure. Gave a lot of extra opportunities for stunts to step in.
Absolutely. And I'll give all the credit to my stunt guys. I mean, they were amazing. He did so much. And because in the beginning, obviously, I'd like to do stunts, some stunts, but no, this is all him. Like, it was so hot in that thing. Like, just doing normal walking, I was just drenched in sweat. The instant that hood went over my head, it was a ticking clock of how sweaty I was. And everyone that worked with me on Team DK knows how wet. Like, I'm soaked. Like, between every take, there's this, like, fan that I used to call Makita. Because there's just, like, this industrial Makita drill turned into a fan. And I called for Makita all the time. I was like, Makita! Makita! I need Makita. Because it's so hard. You know, there's one day near the end when during the finales and you're just doing the sword fights. And I tried to do just a little tiny sequence of what the, you know, my stunt double was doing the entire sequence. And I almost freaked out. Like, I was like, okay, I'm hyperventilating. I was like, I got to stop for a second. I'm sorry. But, yeah, no, it is no joke in that thing. And so much love and credit goes to, the stunt team. They smashed it, especially mine. He took so much pain to make it look amazing. And it looks amazing. Just to see him, because I can't move like that. And you see him do the stuff in that outfit, in that cape. Hell, I was falling over my cape whenever I walked backwards. That's how you defeat Dragon King if I'm playing it. Make me walk backwards. I will fall over my cape. There's actually a great little clip where I'm with Chris, who plays Brainwave, and we're on a green screen. I just fall over backwards. Just standing there. So, yeah, it's all my stunt guy.
Amazing. They are top to bottom an amazing stunt team in general.
Oh my God. I was just jaw dropping seeing some of the stuff that Brex stunt that was doing. Everyone, like, just they're flying and crawl, you know, flying along the wall. And that's all practical. That's like real shit. You know, they're really running along the wall. And I was, you know, just really, really just blown away by how amazing they are. And they would just stick every landing. You're like, oh, I'm just going to do that flip and land. And every one of them was like, wow, all these things are necessary to, because if we lack on the action, the show falls apart.
Absolutely.
You know, and it just takes this entire amazing, talented team together to make it look that good. And, you know, and the great thing is also there's no one with egos. No one's like, oh, I need to do that. I want to do that. You know, it's just like, no, you're tag in, you know. Don't pass out, you know, because it looks so amazing whenever you see it. It's just stunning. It still takes my breath away sometimes when I watch some of the sequences.
And looking at the cast, it's really the cast is almost a reflection of the characters they're playing, because you have guys like you and Neil and Chris and Joy who have been working all kind of around the same amount of time.
Yeah.
And you all have just these super prolific resumes full of experience, all these different roles you've played.
Yeah.
I think Joy's been in like 64 things. Yeah. My
yeah.
God.
Yeah.
And then you have these new kids.
Yeah.
Who, Breck's probably the most experienced of yeah. them, but they're all fairly new.
Yeah.
Just coming into this, and it's really a reflection of their characters. They're all yeah. the same.
And I think there's yeah, absolutely. And I think that translates too, right? You see that come off, and I think they did an amazing job of casting. The cast are just so talented, so perfect for every role that they're in. And you know, you get hats off to casting, to Jeff, and to just have the just knowing exactly what the show needed. Because every one of them just like perfect. And you're right, like these things, like it's nice to see that they kind of mirror each other in their character and their real life. Because then that just makes it that much easier to come across.
And what do you think was your biggest challenge in playing Dragon King?
I'll be honest, finding his voice in the beginning. Like I said, you know, all joking aside, obviously I wasn't going to do Cobra Commander, but it was very fun to do in the makeup chair every day, to everyone's amusement. But, yeah, in the beginning, I remember I was just going around the house, just doing lines, doing just like same lines and different voices, doing lines, different voices. I kept going through so many different iterations of stuff, and I'll never forget, you know, and, you know, Jeff totally gave me free rein, did not give me references. We talked about a few things, and I was like, okay, we're going to try this. And I remember first day on set, I was, you know, just seeing with Neo, in episode 4. And I just like, you know, and I kind of bounced the voice off Neil in the beginning. He's like, what do you think? And he's like, yeah, that, I think that can work. And so we're doing the scene and it's like just me there looking at this mural. Of course, the mural that you're very familiar with. Beautiful job. Even though it was missing me. So I'm staring at the mural and I do the voice.
I photoshopped you in there.
I know. I love, you know, it's, I wish I could show you. It's hanging. I can see it right now hanging over my bookshelf. Thank you. It's awesome. It's my favorite thing.
I'm glad you like it.
But yeah, definitely I had a little butt hurt in the beginning. But yeah, no, when I was doing the voice and I did it and then we were like, cut. Okay, let's do another one. I was like, ooh. I'm going to get to keep this. And it was like really like this low and breathy thing. Like I was like really old. And I was like, in the beginning, I was doing like this. And I remember we went through a couple of takes and I was like, oh, cool. I'm going to get to keep it. And then after like take 3, I see the entire group walk towards me, like Jeff, the director, the writers. Like, and I remember in my head, I was like, I'm about to lose this voice. I remember they came up. They're like, hey, yeah. So really like it. Why don't we try something else? Let's just try it. I was like, okay, I just tried it. But, you know, but it was great. But the thing is, they never put pressure. And, you know, eventually we just found the right balance between them. And, you know, it was great. It's such a key part of him. Because, like you said, there's no facial movements. You can't see anything. So it's about how he moves and how he sounds. So that, to me, was massively important.
So, yeah, you're trying to imply age and the reptilian nature and menace.
Yeah, because I can't just be, hey guys, I'm Dragon King, so what are we doing today? You know, it just wouldn't really be the same. If I was just like...
So that's how it should be played if Dragon King ever shows up on the Harley Quinn cartoons.
Yes, you know it would be. You know, it would be like, hey, I'm Dragon King.
I have to let you know, before you got a hold of me yesterday... the day before, we had recorded an episode just generally about the actors playing U5 main bad guys. It posted today, in fact. And if you listen to that, you will hear me saying that I fully expect you, Nelson Lee, to blow up huge real soon.
Well, thank you very much. Let's hope that's true. But I mean, you know what? It was so much fun doing that show. Like if whatever comes of it, that's the thing. That's one benefit of being in the industry for a while and having ups and downs. I never just bet everything on anything anymore. You know, I'm never like, oh my God, this is going to be it. Cause when I was younger, I used to be like, see you later, suckers. And then you're like, okay, that didn't work. You know, you just keep thinking, dude. But you know, the most important thing is being proud of what you do. And I'm super proud of what we did in this, what everyone else put in, and what I think the show is going to become.
Have you got like children, nieces, nephews who are super excited for you to be on a superhero show?
I do. Like, I've got tons of nieces and nephews. I shouldn't say tons. I've got 6. And it's funny, they're all kind of varying ages from like super small to like teenagers, like 16. Definitely they're, I show them pictures of like Dragon King and stuff. They're like, what? And I'll show pictures of, you know, the reveal and they're like, what? But actually the one that they're more, you know, my niece is more excited about Mulan, but the boys are excited about Stargirl. So it's a nice little like cross section of what they're excited about. And then the young ones are like, I don't know.
Yeah, Mulan's another really big thing. And I'm excited to see that.
Yeah, I mean, we were supposed to release on March 19th, was it? I think. And yeah, obviously that got changed. We now are releasing July 27th. 24th, July 24th. Which is, you know, it's still going to be great. I still think it's a little, you know, I don't know if we'll be back to normal by then. But, you know, it's still better that we didn't air. I mean, basically, we did the world premiere March 9th here in L.A. And it was, like, amazing. We had this huge spectacle and we're doing everything. And I think about that day. I'm like, wow, that that probably was like a super spreader day where we were just like hugging and kissing and, you know, high-fiving everyone and like with all the reporters and everything and that thing. But
crammed into a theater.
Yeah, crammed into a theater. And then within a few days, I remember it was all pushed, canceled. Our, you know, I was supposed to go to Toronto for the world premiere, a Canadian premiere there. That got canceled. And then a few days after that, they're like, oh, yeah, we're postponing. And it's the best decision. It would have been it's a shame. Obviously, I'm not complaining about the show, the movie not being aired compared to the deaths and the illnesses that's happening with COVID. But it's one of those things you just get sad when you get expectations about something being released to the world. You're proud of it.
Yeah, you were real excited about it, and now you have to wait longer.
Yeah, but you know, at least it's got another day, and it's, you know, and that it wasn't kind of not wasted, but just released at a time when no one could see it. So I'm glad about that, and we have a little bit of breathing room between now and then. But yeah, no, I'm excited for the world to see it. I think that's another thing that's just going to be just super proud, and I think it was awesome to be on that too.
I have to say, the only of the Disney live action remakes that I've seen is none of them, because I have not cared at all. Yeah. This is the only one I've actually had an interest in.
And I think this one sets itself apart. Nikki Caro, the director, is so amazing. You know, she's so fantastic. She just knocked it out of the park with this. I think it's something, I know Disney probably doesn't want to be described this way, but you know, I think it's very un-Disney in many ways. And I think that's a strength. You know, it's because I think that's the thing, having watched some of the other ones, you know, it's trying to stay too close to the originals. And I think this one just decided that we're going to make, because I mean, this is the story of Mulan is from the 6th century, you know, and the fact that it can persist and be retold this many times and still be relevant is that at the heart of it, it's a story about family, a story about honor, you know, and that's something that everyone can relate to, at least family. And I think that's the thing that they just wanted to focus on, especially these days. It's so apropos of, like, you know, for women finding strength, getting voices, and just like showing that they are not just equal, but can be so much more than the things that society puts upon them. It's a beautiful story, beautifully told. Visuals are amazing. I think it's going to be great, and I don't think people are going to miss that there's no music, no singing. You know, obviously there's music, there's nice little nods, and there's Easter eggs laid throughout, but I love that it's decided to, that Nikki and Disney gave, you know, her the ability to make her movie, her version of Mulan. And
yeah, I think not having Mushu the dragon and not having the musical numbers is really, it makes it less of a remake and more of like, we're gonna tell the story of Mulan just straightforward now.
Yeah, and I love, like, the cast that they assemble is amazing, like, from everything, where from legends to like people who just like for the first time doing a big movie. I mean, heck, it's a $200 million movie. I've never done a movie that big. You know, it's huge. You know, the scale and the epic kind of vastness of everything. Like, you step on those sets. My first day was on this in the throne room, and you step in, and it was like they literally just finished it. No one had shot in there. And my first day was just me walking in it. And I was like, holy crap. Like, this is all real. There's no green.
And this one was in China, right?
We were supposed to be shooting in China, but we ended up shooting mostly in New Zealand. So, but there are still shots done in China, but the principal photography mostly was in New Zealand, which is so beautiful. I mean, like, some of these scenes, like the background is so, so vivid and brilliant and beautiful. It looks fake. And you're like, yeah, that's green screen. It's like, no, that's real. They built that thing with that mountain behind it, you know? And you're just like, wow.
There's a reason the greatest trilogy of all time was shot there, I guess.
Absolutely. And trust me, I went to a lot of those spots and you're like, yes, it's so cool. And that's similar. Like, you know, you think, it's funny you say that, because I thought about that. I was like, this is what they think they must thought when they're doing Lord of the Rings. And, you know, they're just like over there going, wow. You know, they step on there with those costumes and work is done. You know, that's half the battle.
Yeah.
You literally, you show up in that costume in that environment. You're like, good, I bought it.
So you get to be in this $200 million movie. And in this one, people get to see your face. That's got to be a win.
Yeah, I mean, yes, they do get to see my face. Luckily, I'm not, except, you know, the only thing I have is the costumes are amazing in Mulan. And my beard is my own beard, so I'm proud about that. Everyone else had a fake one. But it is interesting. I mean, look, it's funny, like, people are like, well, is it going to be crappy for you in Stargirl that no one knows it's you? I was like, I kind of think that's great. You know, I think, and also these days, let's face facts. Everyone's just going to one Google and you're going to know who it is. It's not like back in the day, like, I don't know who that is. It's like, oh, really? These days, it's going to be, oh, cool. It's this person.
It wasn't too long ago that would not have happened
exactly.
Anyone that, like, it just actors wouldn't let their egos do that.
Yeah.
You look at 1995's Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
Sylvester Stallone had that helmet on for like 3 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And then he's like, no, I need to see me.
And I think the first time that you really had an actor fully covered for the entire movie that was an A-list star was Jim Carrey as the Grinch.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People made a big deal out of the fact that you just never see him as Jim Carrey in the whole movie.
Yeah.
But that's what the movie is. And it didn't hurt his career at all. I think that's why Carl Urban doesn't take his Dredd helmet off ever.
He did. Yeah, I was about to say that because he doesn't do it the entire time. And I love that Dredd. That Dredd was awesome.
Oh, yeah. We need six more of those.
Yeah, no, that was great. I was like, what? Why are we not doing another one of these? It was so good. And so I love, look, anytime you give me a contained plot of climbing up a tower to the main baddie, I'm in. I am in. Give me that any day. I'll take it. I love that. But
absolutely.
No, yeah, his performance was so fun, and it was a great remake of that. As far as wearing the mask, I love it. I was so excited about it.
All right, so last question.
Mm-hmm.
If you were cast on the show and got to pick whatever character you wanted to play other than Dragon King, who would you pick?
Ooh. It'd be real fun to be Grundy, just so I could do Grundy voice. I think it'd be pretty fun to do, Brainwave might be kind of fun to play, Chris's role, just cause he's got that really cerebral kind of, quality, which I guess is kind of similar to, DK. I think almost any of them would be fun just to be a cocky guy like Sportsmaster too, but yeah, it would be fun just to be good old Grundy. Just to do that voice in a booth all day, it'd be awesome.
The entire show has a fantastic dynamic, and we're recording this obviously before the show has come out, so we don't know the wide response to it, but I think it's going to be amazing. I think everyone's going to really love it.
Yeah, I think so too. And you know, you always hope for that, because when you're proud about something, you hate when people are like, oh really, you didn't like it? But you know, that's, there's nothing you can do about that. All we can do is we hope that we know that we put in our best effort and we, you know, kick butt. And Jeff is so awesome. And you know, everyone that working on it, you know, you, including you, Sean. I mean, it was just such a brilliant, great group of people that love this thing. And I think that's going to show. And I think that's what people are going to love.
Absolutely. Well, Nelson, thank you so much for being so kind with your time and joining us here on the show.
Absolutely. Anytime, Sean.
Stargirl After Show.
So Nelson's a pretty fun guy.
Yeah. I was surprised listening because he sounds so different than he does as Dragon King. I was getting vibes of Misha Collins from Supernatural with the voice there. But in real life, yeah, he's just a fun, great guy.
Just like Misha Collins, he doesn't sound anything like Castiel.
Exactly. Yeah.
Same with Jensen Ackles.
Oh, yeah.
Jensen Ackles sounds nothing like Dean Winchester. Welcome back to the Supernatural Podcast. So I have a confession. When I started off that interview, I said, you sound a lot less creepy than Dragon King. I was guessing. We conducted that interview before the show came out, and I had never heard Dragon King's voice.
Oh.
But I was like, it's got to be creepy, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and I was right.
Definitely was.
I think it would be weird if it was just Nelson speaking in his natural speaking voice.
Yeah. Although I kind of wish he did do that, the Cobra Kai voice.
The Cobra Commander voice?
Cobra Commander, yeah. That would be...
Yeah, Cobra Commander is a straight ripoff of Dragon King.
Oh, okay.
I mean, clearly.
Yeah.
With the hood, not the visor helmet, Cobra Commander, but the hood.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess is when he's not in battle. But yeah, that was Nelson Lee, everybody. Check out his other works. We're still waiting for Mulan to come out at some point.
Mm-hmm.
If we ever manage to not be being murdered by a virus.
Yeah. Here's hoping that happens soon.
Oh, yeah. Not looking good. Not looking good.
Not right now.
So that's it for us. We already told you all the social stuff and the other podcasts you can find us on. So go do all that stuff. We'll see you next week. And we're going to leave you now with a clip of our interview with Christopher James Baker. We'll see you next week. And until then, have a super great day.
Hello, this is Christopher James Baker, and you are listening to the Stargirl After Show. Then you get on Google and go, who is the brainwave? And you see that he's got an enormous cranium and wears basically a green
robe,
a muumuu, if you will. And that's even more exciting. but then you get sent a text or shown a picture from LJ, the supersuits designer, and you see how ridiculously cool your supersuit's going to be. And then you get very excited.
Stargirl After Show is a production of Fandom Limb Media.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.